Greetings, everyone, and welcome to episode 22 of the Yogic Studies podcast. I'm your host, Seth Powell. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Kate Hartman from the University of Wyoming to discuss our recent launch of Buddhist Studies Online. If you haven't heard already, Buddhist Studies Online, or BSO, is the new sister platform to Yogic Studies. It's an online educational platform dedicated entirely to Buddhist studies. As you'll hear in today's episode, this is something that has been in the works for several years, something that many in the yogic studies community have been asking for in varying ways, looking for academic and research-based courses on history and philosophy of Buddhism. And just this week, this has come to fruition. On Monday, we officially launched the website and the first course, BSO 101, an intro to Buddhism, is open for enrollment. Buddhist Studies Online aims to bridge the gap between the meditation cushion and the academy. It offers online courses and trainings on the history, philosophy, and soon the languages of Buddhism, seeking the balance between the highest standards in academic scholarship, yet readily accessible, affordable, and meaningful for the modern practitioner. Like yogic studies, our approach is academic and non-sectarian. We do not seek to replace instruction offered by experienced Buddhist teachers or lineage holders, but believe that the academic and practice-based study of Buddhism are complementary. We welcome students of all backgrounds, whether experienced meditators, weekend yogis, aspiring scholars, or simply someone interested in learning more about Buddhism. To learn more and to check out our current schedule of upcoming courses, be sure to visit BuddhistStudiesOnline.com and please sign up for the new mailing list over there. All right, so in today's episode, we get to sit down with Kate to learn about her story, her background in academia and Buddhism. We'll talk about how we first met as grad students at Harvard, building course websites for Harvard professors. We talk about her fascinating research on pilgrimage and the importance of place and perception within the Buddhist traditions. Kate gives us then a sneak peek at her upcoming online course, the first ever for Buddhist Studies Online. This is BS 101, Intro to Buddhism, History, Philosophy, and Practice. We discuss what we can and cannot say about a historical Buddha, early evidence for the Buddhist tradition, the Four Noble Truths, common misperceptions about Buddhism, and much more. Dr. Kate Hartman is a scholar of Buddhism and a professor of Buddhist studies. She received her PhD in Buddhist studies from Harvard University in 2021. Her research explores the theory and practice of Tibetan pilgrimage to holy mountains and focuses on the goal of transforming perception. She also holds an MA in the history of religions from the University of Chicago and a BA in religious studies from the University of Virginia. She is currently assistant professor of Buddhist studies in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at the University of Wyoming. And as you'll hear in today's episode, as part of her training, Kate has spent extended periods of time living in Asia. She spent summers backpacking across India, living with Tibetan Buddhist nuns in Ladakh, in Dharamsala working in the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, studying at the Dungwong Caves in China, traveling to Lhasa in Tibet, and conducting research around Bodh in Nepal. She speaks modern colloquial Tibetan and conducts research in classical Tibetan and Sanskrit. All right, without further ado, please join me in welcoming the new director of Buddhist Studies Online, Dr. Kate Hartman. All right. Welcome, everyone. I am here with Dr. Kate Hartman. Kate, welcome to the Yogic Studies podcast. It's just a pleasure to have you here today. How are things going and where are you right now?
Thanks so much, Seth. And hello, everyone. I'm so pleased to be joining you here on the podcast. I am coming to you from my office in Laramie, Wyoming. I am an assistant professor of Buddhist studies at the University of Wyoming, and it is a lovely spring day of 44 degrees outside here in Wyoming.
All right. Very nice. Well, it's a beautiful afternoon here in Northern California as well. Spring is in bloom, and it's been an exciting week, right? Just yesterday, so we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, and just yesterday, we officially launched Buddhist Studies Online, a new educational platform for Buddhist studies. And I think, as our listeners will know, Kate is the new director of Buddhist Studies Online. So congratulations, Kate, on the launch of Buddhist Studies Online.
Yeah, and congratulations to you too, Seth. We've spent a lot of time together over the past, you know, couple months leading up to this, getting ready and planning. And so it was so, you know, exciting to hit live on all of the materials after, you know, all of this plotting and planning for months and months.
For sure. I'm sure listeners can relate if you've been kind of working on something behind the scenes for a while, for a long time here. We'll talk about how this all came to be in a second, but it's a little bit nerve-wracking. We're definitely a little bit anxious to hit that release button on Monday morning, but really exciting. And thanks to everybody who's been reaching out through email, through social media. The response that we've been getting, I think, from both academic colleagues, from other researchers and teachers from universities, as well as from the yogic studies community and kind of just the broader Facebook and Instagram communities. It's been really inspiring and affirming for us, just the response I think that we've gotten so far. Is that right, Kate?
Yeah, you know, you're always scared to hit live on something like this and just, you know, no one's going to pay attention. But folks seem really excited to delve more into the history and philosophy of Buddhism, which just makes me, as the director, as the instructor of the first course, and just as like someone involved in this, really excited to dive in with a bunch of excited people.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit about how this came to be. You know, listeners, I think, know Yogic Studies has been going since early 2018. And it started off really small. It was just myself teaching courses and sharing my own research and graduate training in yoga studies and wanting to develop a platform to share my own teaching and research. And it really quickly grew into something much bigger than myself and was able to tap into this larger field of yoga studies and to bring on so many vibrant scholars and teachers, you know, from around the world to teach a whole host of topics far beyond anything that I could do myself. So Yogic Studies has now really become this educational platform, as I say, and an online school, really. And over the last couple of years, slowly, we would get questions from students, things like, is there anything that exists like this online for Buddhism or for Buddhist studies? And I kind of scratch my head and say, not really, or not that I'm aware of. I think there's quite a bit of Buddhism online and online courses that one can take to explore Buddhist teachings and Buddhist Dharma teachings. But there really wasn't anything like yogic studies that takes a more academic approach, a non-sectarian approach, which I think is, we'll talk more about, but I think is a big deal with Buddhist studies, that we're not presenting the teachings and the philosophy, the practices of Buddhism from one specific Buddhist lineage or tradition, but we're going to kind of look at topics like meditation and suffering and non-self and all of these things, but from a, you know, a horizontal broader perspective, cutting across Buddhist traditions. And looking around, it didn't seem like there was really something like this that existed yet, that's interdisciplinary, and that can really bring together some of the leading scholars and teachers in Buddhist studies. So this idea had been growing for a while, but I knew I couldn't do it myself. I have training in Buddhist studies, but it's not my area of specialization these days. Obviously, I'm a yoga guy, and although as we know, there's so many interesting and important confluences between yoga and Buddhism, and maybe we can talk more about that later today. But I knew to really run something like Buddhist studies online, I needed to find somebody who was really firmly rooted in the field of Buddhist studies and deeply immersed in the Buddhist world. But I also needed to find somebody who had some tech skills, some, you know, a little bit of even web design, and who could administer and run things on the back end, because there's just a lot that goes on with managing and overseeing an academic and online platform like this. And as I was thinking about who that person might be, Kate was kind of one of the first people that came to mind. Kate, maybe you can tell a little bit about, you know, how we first met at Harvard, and kind of how the seeds for this maybe got planted several years ago at Harvard University.
Yeah, so we were both PhD students together. I believe I'm a year sort of ahead of Seth. And, you know, we had a lot of the same advisors. Those of us in Asian studies kind of stuck together. We would have, you know, these gatherings on Fridays with free pizza. And of course, all the graduate students would show up so that we could eat the free pizza. And so we got to be friends over that. But I think our friendship really solidified when we were both working as academic technology consultants at Harvard Divinity School, which is to say that we were the ones managing and setting up Canvas sites for Harvard professors' courses, because the technology can be sort of fiddly and hard to work. And a lot of the, especially the older Harvard professors, like to have some help. And so we would do that, and we would record events, and we were sort of on the tech side of things. And so as part of that job, we also got to have an office, which was a very big deal because graduate students did not have offices in our department. But we would sit in this nice little basement room that had a nice window and big computer screens and just work. And in between all the working, we got to chatting and talking and exploring a lot of these ideas. We also spent a semester teaching, you know, essentially an intro to Buddhism course. We were both teaching assistants for my advisor, Dr. Janik Yatso. And, you know, through the course of all of these things, we were just, you know, I always appreciated that Seth had this great sense of humor, that he was such an open and engaging instructor, that he was like a smart guy, you know, totally on top of it in terms of the tech stuff. And, you know, so when we started talking about this idea in particular, I was just so excited to get involved.
Yeah, it's amazing to think how those experiences at Harvard, and especially on the tech side and the web side, developing websites for online courses. I think, I mean, neither of us had any idea at the time that that's what we would be doing after Harvard. But it's true that those experiences really did play a role in developing the skill set that now translates, I think, really well into teaching and facilitating courses online.
Yeah. And I remember that you had been doing it for slightly longer than me. I think you started a semester before.
I think I got you the job, Kate.
Yeah, I should have. Thank you for that. And there wasn't like quite as much training. I think they just assumed that because we were in our 20s, like we could figure it out. But you actually did a lot of the training for me. And I think probably the first time I ever heard the word module was you saying it. Little did I know that we'd be, you know, all thrown into this all online world.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we'll get into that, I think, a little bit later. But, you know, this past year, because of COVID-19 and the pandemic, it really has shifted things in higher education. And all of a sudden, everybody is teaching online and Zooming and in some ways becoming experts, or at least becoming more familiar with these technologies. And I think it's really shifting how we view online education and something like Buddhist studies online. So I want to get into that a little bit more later. But to kind of dig in a little deeper, maybe we can back up.
Why don't you tell us a little bit more about your story, you know, how you got to Harvard, and then now where you're at the University of Wyoming as a professor. So tell us a little bit about your background in academia, in Buddhism, maybe some of your time that you've spent abroad in India and Asia, and how those, all of those experiences have kind of shaped the research and teaching that you do.
Yeah. So I grew up in New Jersey. And one of the things about how I grew up was that I came from a mixed religious family. My mother's family was Jewish. My father's family was Catholic. My mom converted to first mainline Protestantism and then evangelical Christianity when I was quite young. And so my overall impression growing up was hearing all of these ideas about how the world worked, you know, what was sort of the problem that led to the suffering in our lives and different ideas about how you overcame that. And so from a young age, I was just this, you know, weird little kid, always interested in these big, big questions. And so when I went to undergraduate, I went to the University of Virginia. I immediately started signing up for religious studies courses. And in my head, they were just kind of a fun distraction. I was planning to be a medical doctor and, that, you know, would just do some religion on the side for a personal interest. But little did I know that when I was going to the University of Virginia, this wasn't a factor in why I chose to go there. The University of Virginia has one of the best Buddhist studies, and in particular, one of the best Tibetan Buddhist studies programs in the country.
Yeah.
You know, huge amount of incredible professors, graduate students, a lot of language resources that, you know, I didn't even realize how lucky I was to have access. And so I started out by taking Hindi because I'd gotten far enough in Spanish that really the only thing left to do was to analyze literature and plays in Spanish. And I was like, ugh, I don't want to do that. I'll just start with a new language at like the 101 level and that'll be fun.
Mm. And what brought you to Hindi of all languages?
So growing up in New Jersey actually has the highest percentage of Indian immigrants in the country. And so I grew up with lots of friends who were, whose parents were Indian immigrants or were who were non-resident Indians in some capacity. And so one of my closest friends growing up was actually Jain, yet another sort of early religious experience that piqued my interest. And so all through high school, we would watch Bollywood movies together and you know, so when I saw that they offered Hindi, I was like, I'm finally going to learn to understand what those Bollywood movies are saying that I love so much.
Nice.
And so I took a year of Hindi and then I had a summer where I was able to travel to India. And really, I picked India because I was like, well, I've got a year of Hindi, I'll be able to get around. Little did I realize, of course, it takes many years to be fluent enough in a language, but, you know, I at least had kind of something to work with. And so at the age of 19, summer after my sophomore year of college, I spent 4 months in India, just backpacking around northern India, up and down the Ganges, loved it, came back, took some more courses, trying to figure out how I could go back over the summer, ended up picking up Sanskrit and Tibetan, and starting writing research grants so that, you know, the university could fund my, you can't see the air quotes over the podcast, but research in India. Mm. And so as part of that, I lived in a Tibetan Buddhist nunnery in Zanskar, which is a valley in Ladakh in the Indian province of Jammu and Kashmir.
Wow.
In northern India. And I lived there for 4 months doing research for my senior thesis.
That's amazing. We Charlotte and I spent a summer in Ladakh, and I often pine and dream of going back to Ladakh. It's such a unique and incredible Himalayan landscape. So I can imagine 4 months in a nunnery, did you say?
Yeah, it was a Tibetan Buddhist nunnery. And so, you know, to get there from Leh, you would take a 14-hour bus ride to Kargil, and then another 14-hour bus ride to Padum, the capital of Zanskar. And then it was a 5-hour walk to Karsha, the village that I lived in. And they had a monastery and a nunnery.
Wow.
And the nunnery had about 22 nuns, and I lived there. And at that point, I had had 2 years of Hindi and 1 year of Tibetan.
Okay.
They spoke a regional dialect of Tibetan known as Zanskari that was not at all similar to the book Tibetan I had learned in the classroom.
Mm.
But, you know, you hang around, you follow around, you point at things, you figure it out. the nuns were such great sports about, you know, having me hang around and slowly trying to learn the language and trying to learn what their lives were like. It was just this incredible experience.
Mm.
And
you must have drinking a lot of yak butter tea.
Yes. And I never quite developed a taste for it. But the thing is, so for those of you who don't know, Tibetan tea or pocha is churned with butter and salt. So it's actually more like, you kind of have to think of it as a soup almost, mm-hmm. rather than a tea. And so you churn it up and they pour it for you. And if you don't drink it, it'll get kind of cold and all the butter will rise from the tea and sort of congeal on the top. And you want to avoid that. Yeah. So drink the tea just to kind of keep things moving. And then you'd get poured more tea.
And I think really meant for like cold winter climates, right? Like this nice warm, thick drink to fill your belly, right? I can remember trying it in the summertime and thinking it's probably not the right season for this. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's you know, perfect food for like, let's say you're a nomad, not a whole lot grows up at these incredibly high altitudes, not a lot of vegetables. So you get this, you know, really calorie rich, buttery, salty tea, and then you can mix this roasted barley flour tsampa in it. Mm-hmm. And it's really, you know, kind of an all in one meal. It's got everything you need.
Yeah, I can remember being in some monasteries in Ladakh, and just as a guest, as a visitor coming in, and just kind of observing during a ceremony or kind of a moment of worship. And they would, usually the younger monks would come around and hand out all of the bowls and come around with these big vats of butter tea, pouring them, and then coming around and filling in the sampa. And, you know, just as a guest there, you would always just be loaded up with all this. And we'd have to very politely say, no, no more, no more.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you didn't say it forcefully enough, they wouldn't believe you, because it was polite to sort of refuse things a couple times. And then they'd be like, oh, no, I insist. And sometimes you had to be like, please, no, I'm full. I've had so much tea.
Yeah. So you were at the nunnery, were you studying Tibetan at that time?
Kind of, although I didn't have a teacher or anything. I was just sort of wandering around, and I had gotten a Ladakhi English dictionary and, you know, would point at words in the dictionary and the nuns would either nod or shake their heads. And it was more like language learning sort of on the go. I spent a lot of time in the kitchen because that's a nice way to make yourself kind of useful. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of things to point at and have them say the word and then you can learn it. So really cannot say enough about the kindness of these nuns who allowed me, as you know, just this young person who didn't know very much, to learn from them and to benefit from their company and their like incredible good humor. So after writing my senior thesis, I then went back because I had won, you know, an award based on that senior thesis. I went back for another, this time it was like 3 months after I had graduated, to live in that same nunnery. And then I started at the University of Chicago. I did a master's in the history of religions focused on Tibetan Buddhism. And that was great because it allowed me to really just delve into both Sanskrit and Tibetan. So I spent 2 years doing that. In the course of that, I spent a summer in Dharamsala, which mm-hmm. is the capital of the Tibetan government in exile. I was doing research at the Tibetan Library of Works and Archives.
Mm-hmm.
And then proceeded on to Harvard.
Hold on. Before you get to Harvard, I got to acknowledge the Dharamsala and the library. We spent like, I think 3 or 4 summers in a row hanging out in the hills of Dharamsala. And I can just picture right now that steep kind of climb down the hill that there to the library, which was always fine going down. But I can remember after like a day of studying or receiving teachings from maybe a visiting Lama or something, that like the climb back up it at the end of the day was always much harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've always been a runner. Like one of my long-term interests is distance running. And I would try to run in India, which is hard for a couple of reasons. One, for sort of to respect cultural norms and modesty, you're wearing kind of, you're staying covered. So you're just wearing a lot of clothes, which can be hot if you're trying to run in the summer in monsoon season. And then it's all just really that one hill.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a challenging summer of running for me.
Yeah.
I was actually living on the grounds of the Tibetan government exile. There was,
down the hill there.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I know that. I know those dwellings there, and that's a very interesting space because, as you just said, it is the government of Tibet in exile there in northern India. And of course, the main temple there is His Holiness the Dalai Lama's temple in Dharamsala. Mm-hmm. So you must have had some interesting experiences there.
Yes. No, my bedroom overlooked the Nechung Monastery, which is the monastery associated with the Dalai Lama's traditional oracle.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I was always like living in fear that I wouldn't, you know, I'd forget to like close the curtains correctly or something. And I, you know, some sort of horrible thing would happen where I was, you know, making a fool of myself in front of the Nechung Oracle or the Tibetan Sikyong, the president of the government in exile.
Since you brought that up, that is just a really interesting phenomenon or entity or, you know, or unique component, let's say, of Tibetan Buddhism. What is the oracle of the Dalai Lama? What is the Nechung?
Yeah, so the Nechung Oracle is the state oracle of Tibet. And this is, you know, we'll talk about this more later, but one of the interesting things about how Buddhism sort of gets adopted and practiced and talked about in the US is we tend to want to strip away all of these things that may seem kind of like superstition, perhaps. But historically, Tibetans are deeply interested in astrology, in divination, in predicting the future, in knowing how to make state policy. So that was the Nechung Oracle's role. The Dalai Lama was the head of the Tibetan state, and in making decisions, might consult to the state oracle in order to know how to make a good decision.
Right.
And the oracle would be, you know, there'd be sort of a host for the oracle who was a person, and then they would go into these sort of special like meditative trance states in which the spirit or the deity would possess the person and speak through the person in order to give kind of advice or information to the Dalai Lama that would help him make decisions.
Mm, yeah. And that's a practice that was continued even in exile in India.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Things have changed because as of, you know, within the last 10 years, the Dalai Lama has really tried to separate the kind of religious side of the Tibetan government from the political side of the Tibetan government. Traditionally, you know, since the 1500s, both of those functions would have been together in the person of the Dalai Lama. He was in charge of both the political and the religious side. But the current Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, has tried to step back from the political side and encourage the Tibetan government in exile to adopt democracy. And so, you know, there is a president that is elected by the Tibetan people, and then the Dalai Lama sees himself as the head of the religious side of Tibetan culture.
Yeah, that's a pretty important and notable and distinctly modern, unique change, right, that the Dalai Lama has initiated. I think when we were in Dharamsala, I want to say in 2011 or 12, I think there was the democratic election for the president. I think that was taking place. So all of those experiences in Ladakh and India, and then doing your MA at Chicago and getting these languages, Tibetan and Sanskrit, really under your belt, you knew you wanted to go on to the PhD, and you said you got into Harvard. What were your experiences then at Harvard? Obviously, you know, that's where we met and where our stories link up. But how did you start to develop kind of your research project, and where did your research start to take shape?
Mm-hmm. I will say my first experiences at Harvard were just like an overwhelming sense of fear that everyone else was so much smarter than me and I was going to get laughed at.
Yeah.
But you know, you kind of,
you're probably the only person who's ever had that experience at Harvard.
I'm a true imposter. Everyone's going to find out.
Right. No, I'm joking because it's sort of like, commonplace, let's just say, at Harvard for people to have that feeling, right? I think we all do.
Yeah, no, one of the things that happens, especially when you try to study a tradition like Buddhism that has a 2,500-year-old history, is you think, you know, who am I to pretend to even understand even a tiny bit of this? Who am I to take on these languages that have, you know, challenged people for decades? And, you know, I'm not saying that I don't struggle with those feelings of fear or inadequacy, but at a certain point you do kind of learn to set it aside and try to focus on the joy of the discovery rather than the kind of fear that what you don't know will be exposed. And fortunately, lots of great people at Harvard, like Seth, made a lot of great friends. And initially, I started interested in a history of Tibetan medicine, was initially my project. But I kind of quickly realized that that was not going to be the project for me. It didn't, you know, you end up proposing a project that you think is going to work, and then sometimes it doesn't work out. And you just have to explore your interests, see what works out. But eventually I got interested in Tibetan pilgrimage in particular. And so ended up writing a dissertation about the theme of perception in Tibetan pilgrimage. And in doing the research for that, I spent additional summers in Chengdu, in Dunhuang, in Kathmandu, in Nepal, back in India, and, you know, various other sort of research trips.
Well, pilgrimage is such a great topic for so many reasons, but one of them, you got to go on some pilgrimages. It's a great reason to get back out into the field and explore, you know, sacred sites and places with these research questions in mind. I imagine some of your earlier experiences that you've been talking about too probably helped to kind of give rise to some of those interests and questions. What in particular, because I know this is what you wrote your dissertation on and successfully defended and even graduated. Congratulations, Kate. So what, tell us a little bit about, the specific nature of the dissertation and the shape of your research on pilgrimage.
Yeah. So I always try to frame this in ways that are going to be understandable to folks that are not me, who have not spent, you know, 5 or 6 years immersed in this material. So when I'm talking to folks, I usually say that my dissertation research, broadly speaking, is about the question of how do we change the way we see the world? And Buddhists are really interested in this question of seeing, of perception, because they postulate that human suffering, human wrongdoing, all of these sorts of things are fundamentally caused by a misperception of reality. People don't see reality the way that it is, and that's what leads them to act in negative ways. And so the Buddhist tradition has therefore developed lots of different practices aimed at changing the way that you see the world. Perhaps meditation is the most famous, but there's lots of others. And I read Tibetan pilgrimage as one of these kinds of practices. And so just a bit more about Tibetan pilgrimage for those of you who aren't as familiar with it. The idea is that you're going to travel to this holy mountain. And what the holy mountain is supposed to be is a mandala, a divine palace of a deity or a Buddha of some sort. But as those of you who have looked at a mountain can say, like, mountains don't generally look like that. It looks like a pile of rocks and snow. But the challenge posed to Tibetan pilgrims is to learn to see past this surface appearance, past this ordinary experience, to the divine reality that is the true nature of the mountain. And so in order to do that, pilgrims are challenged to transform their perception, to learn to see this ordinarily invisible world that underlies our ordinary experience. And so my dissertation research looked at how Tibetan texts approached this goal. So I looked at a number of different genres, including advice texts, pilgrimage guides, autobiographies of pilgrims, a pilgrim diary, polemic texts debating about pilgrimage. And in each case, I asked how they approached this goal of learning to see the ordinarily invisible wonders of the pilgrimage place.
Yeah, I like how you frame pilgrimage as a practice. And then interesting that there's these genres of texts that really, and these different types of texts, as you laid out, that detail pilgrimage and these holy sites from these different vantage points. Now, is there something about the hardship of pilgrimage that these sites are in difficult, far out regions, hard to access? Is there something about the hardship that is perhaps even necessary for the type of transformation that a pilgrim is after to take place?
Yeah. Pilgrimage texts that I read a lot of are really interested in the nature of this journey and see it as this moment of sort of overcoming, you know, whatever doubt, whatever sort of wrongdoing you're habitually doing, and taking you out of ordinary life to pursue this religious or spiritual goal. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that texts are actually pretty worried about this journey, because perhaps those of you who have been traveling can attest, like, a lot of us aren't at our best when we're traveling. We get kind of grouchy, and everything that goes wrong makes us angry. And so a lot of pilgrimage texts will talk about the dangers of the road, that, you know, things might get inconvenient, and as a result, you'll fall into a negative mental state or any something of that nature. And so pilgrimage texts are trying to manage the journey and trying to keep pilgrims' minds focused on the goal, this goal of transforming perception, which would then lead you to kind of transform the way that you see the whole world.
Yeah, I know, you know, sometimes in tantric and yogic traditions, there's like the tendency to interiorize external phenomena or even sacred spaces, holy sites, pithas, and so forth within the yogin's own mind and body. I imagine we see that on the Tibetan side. But again, like, is there something, you know, so one could kind of pose the argument from that vantage point, like, why need to go anywhere? Why don't you just sit, you know, on your cushion, meditate, and kind of change your perception right here and now. No need to go anywhere. What is sort of the argument, you know, in favor of, no, it's actually, it is really beneficial and helpful to actually go out, as you said, to kind of get out of your normal habitual mode, to go out on this more external and physical journey.
Yeah,
and it's so interesting. Let me also just, it's interesting to think about that kind of with the pandemic in the background now, you know, where we haven't been able to travel, right, and go out. And I think we've also, maybe we've, some of us have felt, or a lot of us have felt, how lacking, you know, we've been from not getting to go out and do things and see things.
Yeah, this is a really good question. And you're, I might I say that you're channeling Jigme Lingpa? So there's a whole chapter of my dissertation that's called Against Pilgrimage. Mm. And it focuses on debates that Tibetans had about whether it was worth it to engage external pilgrimage places. And these debates would happen sometimes in commentaries on tantric texts. So texts like the Havajra Tantra, which will outline systems of these pithas, these sacred places that you mentioned, and point out how they can be mapped onto the body. And that, yeah, there were external places associated with them, but they were for, in the Tibetan, these chipa people, these childish people. Mm. And so Tibetans would debate whether that meant it wasn't worth it to go to external pilgrimage places because the internal body was good enough. And other people said, no, engaging external places does things that you can't do on your own. Because all of us have had the experience of maybe you go to a special place and without even meaning to or without even expecting it, the mood of the place takes you over. Or you'll go to a place and you weren't even really thinking about it, but you'll have memories of something that happened in that place coming over you. So there's a way that places kind of shape us that are not reducible to, you know, human intention and mind. And so these Tibetan debates about pilgrimage kind of center around that. The question about whether places can do things to people. You know, one approach might be to say that places are just this inert backdrop for human activity, right? And so humans are what matter. You can do the visualizations, you can do the yoga, you can do the transformation all in your own body. And that's why I say that you you're channeling Jigme Lingpa. There's a great poem that Jigme Lingpa writes where he said, you know, real practice consists in the generation stage and the completion stage. These are two stages of tantric meditation. Mm. If you do that right, you'll get enlightened without having to leave your bedroom. But against that, other people would say, well, no, these places are powerful. And if you sit down and you try to map out these pilgrimage places in your body, or you sit down and you try to visualize a mandala, it's just a different sort of task than if you go out into the world and allow these special places to transform you. And so the people who were in favor of pilgrimage in the Tibetan context thought there was an important place, unintentional pun there, but for place, the fact that there are certain special places, special mountains that people have been going to for pilgrimage for hundreds of years, that sacred masters went there and meditated there and left their blessings there. And people sort of devote their attentions to it. And then going to those places actually does transform you. It brings you into a certain mindset. It connects you with those past masters that were there. And
yeah, I might have been channeling Jigme Lingpa, but I've had so many experiences to the other side of being in these special places in India in particular, that it really can be quite transformational.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it does, you know, the question about, you know, here we are in the pandemic when place has kind of been collapsed. We can Zoom from California to Wyoming. And, you know, in my classes, there's these great Google Arts and Culture visualizations where you can kind of walk through various pilgrimage places in India.
Right.
And I'll bring classes and we'll kind of go to Amaravati or Sanchi or all these places. And, you know, it's an interesting question to ask. Why bother buying the plane ticket? Why bother with the hassle and bustle of traveling?
I don't know.
There is something.
Yeah, there's something I do too. There. Like I've seen at Harvard, they're doing the 3D modeling of the Dungwang caves. Have you seen any of that?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, some other sacred sites too.
Yeah. I was actually, you know, in Dunhuang a couple of summers ago, and we got to see some of these cameras and these setups for they were trying to do that.
It's an amazing thing. I love that they're doing it. But if one is going to make the argument that digital captured experience is the equivalent to seeing it in person, I don't think so. I think just like, and we'll talk about this more maybe later, I don't think online teaching replaces what we're doing in person in, you know, physical proximity to one another in a classroom. But yet, how many people have the opportunity to go to Dungwang to actually go do that? You know, that's an incredibly privileged and rare thing to have the funds to be able, you know, and time and all of the causes and conditions, right, to be able to go do that. And the same thing with a lot of the courses that we're going to be, you know, offering at Buddhist Studies Online. How many people have the opportunity to go to a Harvard, to go to Oxford, to go to these elite universities, time or money or proximity, and yet moving things into the online collapsed space and place continuum here allows that kind of accessibility that I think was not previously available.
Yes. And it is incredible what can be done that we thought wasn't possible, you know, just, you know, probably like even 3 years ago, people would have been entirely skeptical that you could have any valuable online learning experience, which was ridiculous because there's been people who've been making this work for a long time. And it makes it accessible to a much broader audience that maybe just wants to listen to a recording of a podcast or a class, you know, while they're commuting to work or while they're doing the dishes, or, you know, fit it into their lifestyle. And so I'm all for this kind of expanse, this kind of collapsing of space that's possible for at least in the education space.
Yeah. So you have a unique perspective now because so you finished your PhD, you went on the job market, and you were hired, and you've been teaching at the University of Wyoming. So tell us a little bit about what that experience has been like, and then how things have shifted, you know, with the pandemic and the move to online, and where things are at today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I finished my dissertation in May of 2020, so, you know, right in COVID, and graduated and accepted a job to work here at the University of Wyoming. I'm the Robert H. N. Ho Family Foundation and Buddhist Studies, Assistant Professor of Buddhist Studies here. So I got a shout out to the Robert H. N. Ho Family Foundation and Buddhist Studies, who've made a lot of great positions possible, and they fund a lot of art and museums and galleries and that sort of thing. So, you know, shout out to the Ho family.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, we always have to say thank you to the folks that make a lot of this possible. And so, yeah, when I got started here, it was a really strange time to teach because instantly I was thrown into this online environment. And here at Wyoming, we've been doing hybrid online and in-person. So about half of my students are entirely online asynchronous. Mm-hmm. Half of them are coming in person, and you're dealing with multiple audiences at one time. This semester, I also added synchronous Zoom. So I'm essentially addressing three populations. I've got my people there in person, my people on the synchronous Zoom, my folks at home on the online asynchronous.
So you've always had some students in person though through this?
Yes, except for the first 4 weeks of the first semester.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's interesting though, you know, in some ways my colleagues have been complaining about this, about how they can't wait to go back to normal. But because I started this way, you know, there's nowhere to go but easier. And so I really had to think a lot about how to teach in this environment. And, you know, again, I think I credit a lot of what we learned as academic technology consultants, thinking about how you can make technology work for you and how not to fall into the trap of just trying to move an in-person course online and call it a day.
Right.
You have to design an experience that's suited to the medium that you have available and that's going to work and be flexible and, you know, serve the students. So what that looks like for me is a flipped classroom. I record these pre-recorded little video lectures, and then in class, we're just doing activities or discussion or asking questions and answers. So in an interesting way, I actually reproduced the yogic studies framework there in my own courses.
Right. So what are you teaching right now this semester at the University of Wyoming?
So this semester, I'm teaching some quite broad intro courses. I'm the only one who does any religions of Asia here at the University of Wyoming. So I'm teaching intro to Asian religions and then world religions, which has been fun and challenging for me because I actually don't know a lot about non-Asian religions. So it's been a learning experience. And then last semester, I taught, you know, intro to Buddhism, essentially very similar to the format that I'll teach for your Buddhist studies online. Mm-hmm. And then an upper level course on Buddhist ethics. Mm. That was really fun.
Great. Well, I think that might segue nicely into talking about your upcoming course, the first ever course for Buddhist studies online. This course begins May 3rd. It's a 6-week online course. And why don't you tell us a little bit about it? And maybe kind of a little preview of each of the 6 modules, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so my course starts with the fundamental insight of the Buddha, which is that life is stressful, life is uncertain, life is full of pain and suffering. And, you know, so the question that we ask throughout the course is, you know, if that insight that the Buddha had is true, what do we do about it? And what did Buddhists think that they should do about that? And so, the course tries to survey from the very beginning to Buddhism spread to Asia and to the rest of the world, a sense of what Buddhists thought was the problem with human existence. What was the sort of fundamental cause of this problem of suffering? Mm-hmm. How did they imagine the good life? What was the kind of thing that if you wanted to get out of suffering, you should be striving for? And what did they conceive of as the path from point A to point B? So you kind of have the starting point, the end point, and the path is the framework that I use throughout the course. And in order to study a tradition as rich as Buddhism, we're going to have to be historians thinking about what happened and how did that lead to other things happening? And, you know, what was the context of these developments? What were they responding to? We're also going to be philosophers taking the claims that the Buddha made seriously and asking that if they're true, like what else is true? How do these claims relate to one another? How do they make any sense? And, you know, I also want it to be personally meaningful for people. The challenges that the Buddha identified as, you know, facing people in 500 BCE of stress and suffering are things that I imagine a lot of students, a lot of audience members can relate to. And so even as we're doing this kind of delving into the history and the philosophy, I'm going to make time and space to think about what this means for us being alive today. Yeah. And so maybe I can just go through the kind of six modules.
Yeah, let's do that. And then I'll have some follow-up questions for you.
Yeah. And so each of these is kind of like, you know, 2 weeks in the course that I teach in person. So we start by introducing the Buddha and his world. So what was the Buddha's cultural context? What would someone living in 500 BCE India have thought that the world looked like? What might have they expected after they died? What did they think was the good life? What do they think were the obstacles to that? And, you know, I spend a lot of time setting that up because the Buddha is going to accept some aspects of this general framework and he's going to reject others. But in either case, setting the Buddha in his historical context is really useful. So we'll look at the Buddha's world, we'll look at the life of the Buddha, including his past lives, and you know, come to ask how he got the realizations that led to his central teachings. Then in the second module, we actually get to what the Buddha taught. With all of this background, then we start with what the Buddha taught. How did he understand the origin of suffering and evil? What was his account of the good? How did he think that humans existed in the world? What tends to drive us and what might drive us instead? And so this one, we kind of really delve into the Buddha's early teachings and philosophy to think about how he understood suffering and the possibility of its elimination. Next is focused on some of the practices that Buddhists do in order to accomplish the goals that the Buddha set out in his teachings. So it's not enough to understand the origin of suffering and to imagine a state of without suffering. You have to propose a course of how you get from A to B. And so in particular, we're looking at morality, Buddhist accounts of ethics, what the ethical life looks like, Buddhist monasticism in form of monks and nuns and how they organized their lives, what they thought that had to do with eliminating suffering. And then also meditation and mindfulness, you know, because we hear a lot about meditation and mindfulness, but what role did they play in early Buddhist communities? Mm. From there, we look to changes in Buddhism. Specifically, one of the big developments in Buddhism is Mahayana Buddhism, the so-called Great Vehicle, which developed in India in the centuries after the Buddha's death and became the dominant form of Buddhism in, you know, China, Japan, Tibet. And so we ask, why did this change arise? What did folks who are associated with the Mahayana think that the Mahayana meant? Why do they think it was necessary? What were the kind of key texts and practices associated with it? Then we look at how Buddhism develops once it's moved into these other places. And one of the themes that you'll see in China, Japan, and Tibet is they're interested in attaining enlightenment fast. One of the Buddha's early teachings is that it takes millions and billions and billions of lifetimes to eliminate suffering. Mm. And people started to wonder, is there anything we can do to, you know, speed up that timeline a little bit? And so we're going to be looking at the development of Chan, about Zen, Tantra, Pure Land Buddhism, all of these kinds of developments within the Buddhist tradition, reinterpreting the Buddha's original teachings and trying to think about how it was possible to live in this world of suffering in a different way. And then we end out in the last module of thinking about the future of Buddhism and Buddhism's encounter with modernity. So that'll involve a bit of history. How did Buddhism come to, you know, what we would consider the modern West? What were the kind of colonial encounters that led to Buddhism first being talked about in Europe and America? And how has this encounter changed Buddhism? Not saying that it's bad or good, but we as historians want to understand those changes and think about how it came to be that Buddhism is understood in the way that it is today. And, you know, just end up reflecting on where we are with Buddhism in the modern world and maybe what's coming next. So that is a rapid fire tour through the course.
Fantastic. Yeah. And I, it's wide ranging, but also in depth. I think, this course is going to be of interest to anybody who's interested in Buddhism from all of these different perspectives and levels that Kate has been discussing. I think whether you're somebody who's been studying Buddhism for a while, some of this might be review for you, but I think it's always interesting to hear the story of Buddhism, if you will, presented from a fresh teacher and new lenses. But certainly, if you're new to the study of Buddhism, maybe you're a yoga practitioner, maybe you've studied Buddhism a little bit, but you want to learn more, this is going to be just an incredible deep dive and kind of entryway into the world, the vast and complex world of Buddhisms, plural. And I think we'll set an incredible foundation for all the courses that are to come on Buddhist studies online and really kind of prepare one to enter into the academic field of Buddhist studies. Now, especially for people who are a little bit newer, what I'd like to do now is kind of just throw some questions at you, kind of rapid fire questions. They don't have to be rapid fire answers. And I'm sure for a lot of these questions, there are no simple or rapid fire answers. But I'll just kind of go through some questions of kind of Buddhism 101 here, if you will. And let's see kind of where the conversation takes us. So again, especially for somebody, you know, who's newer to Buddhism, what is Buddhism and who was the Buddha? Was the Buddha a historical person?
Yeah. You know, this is such an interesting question because it's a simple question, and yet you could talk about this for hours and hours, which is probably true of everything that we'll cover in the class. But so one interesting thing to remember is that Buddhism is a category that we are placing, it's a term that we're placing on an incredibly diverse group of people, beliefs, practices, history, that, you know, any one thing you can say about Buddhism, you can find an exception somewhere. But generally, I understand Buddhism to be the tradition of ideas, practices, texts, artworks, and peoples that are inspired by and responding to the Buddha. And with regard to the question of who is the Buddha, some people have asked, you know, is the Buddha a historical person? I'm of the camp that thinks he is, just because it's actually really hard to explain how it'd be an incredible thing for a person to do, but it'd be an even more incredible thing for someone who didn't exist to do, to form this whole religion. And, you know, we don't have a whole lot of material evidence of the Buddha, which is why people start asking these questions, you know, but then again, we don't have a whole lot of evidence from 500 BCE just generally.
Right.
But it does seem that he is a person who was alive somewhere in the 500 BCE era. People debate about the dates, in northern India or southern Nepal, who was one of like a group of teachers in this sort of generation. There were lots of religious wanderers and teachers who gathered followings, and the Buddha was one of them, and proved to have a teaching, form a community that has lasted and, you know, traveled all over the world.
Yeah. So you mentioned evidence. What is some of the earliest evidence that we have for the Buddhist tradition?
Mostly it is the Pali Suttas. There are some sort of early inscriptional evidence. So for those of you who aren't as familiar with the history, people will put up rock carvings, or if they make a donation, they'll, you know, chisel into it, you know, who donated, what was the relative date, who was the king in charge at the time. And so we have some of those going back to, I believe, the 2nd or 3rd century BCE, but not necessarily all the way to the 5th century BCE or the 6th right. century BCE. What we do have is the body of the Buddhist teachings that Buddhists believe are passed down word for word by the Buddhist disciples, and that go all the way back to him. And scholars debate this. It seems likely that there was probably some compiling effort that went into it, probably some editing. According to Buddhist traditions, all of the Buddhist disciples got together after his death to put these things together, but it probably took a couple hundred years for them to be settled into a form. But, you know, call me crazy. I think there's, you know, in these scriptures, kernels of stuff that go back very, very old. And, you know,
right, but it's hard to know. But it is important to be aware that there are these kind of gaps in the timeline, and that the texts that we have, although they're recording these oral teachings, they were codified and written down, you know, hundreds of years after the historical timeline that we have of a Shakyamuni Buddha or a Prince Siddhartha.
And that's something I tell students all the time. So we can have a really interesting conversation about the historical Buddha and about what he actually taught and all that kind of stuff. That's a great conversation to have. But it's an equally interesting conversation to say, okay, well, how did Buddhists of the 3rd century CE imagine the Buddha? Because in some sense, this Buddha that they imagined, the story that they understood of their own teacher, is just as influential, if not more influential, than the actual historical Buddha. The kind of story that the tradition tells itself about where it came from is itself incredibly meaningful to people. So there's, you know, in the earliest Buddhist sources, we don't get very much about the Buddha's life. He gives little bits and snippets, but really nothing even approaching the kind of story that we're all familiar with of the prince who went out and saw 4 sights. I'm just realizing as I said that maybe not everyone's familiar with it. Another reason to take Buddhism 101. But it seems like the sort of traditional story of the Buddha's life wasn't put together in the form that is most famous now for hundreds of years after the Buddha's life. And so that's not to say that that's a story that we should stop telling or it's not valuable. Buddhists told that story because they wanted to understand suffering, and they thought that this story helped them do so. So in a certain way, you have the historical figures, and then you also have a history of the stories that Buddhists tell about these figures that is itself a part of the tradition.
Right. And so when we see all these quotes of the Buddha on Instagram or Facebook, if in fact it is a real quote, which oftentimes it's not, but really what we're saying is, if we're quoting the Buddha, really we're saying, according to the Buddha, according to the Pali Canon, or something like that, right?
Yes. Yes, we're always sort of relying on these traditions that have passed down these texts that have likely sort of edited them or rearranged them, and you know, trying to understand what it is the Buddha was teaching, but knowing that, you know, as the Buddha said, is true of all things, everything changes, and it's hard to pin anything down firmly. So right. Part of what our job is as historians is to view this messy and complex situation and still try to understand a story that's going on through all of it.
And the story of Buddhism is one of change and innovation as Buddhism, you know, spread from India to all of these other countries in Asia and beyond, China and Japan and Korea, Tibet, and elsewhere. So there is constant change and adaptation. But if I were to ask you now, next question, what are some of the core teachings attributed to the Buddha, at least, that Buddhists hold, that maybe not all Buddhists, but what are, you know, some of the, you know, things that we can point to that are core teachings of the Buddha?
So, you know, coming out of this discussion of change, I would say for my money, the core teaching of the Buddha and everything else follows from this core insight is that everything is impermanent. Change is the fundamental fact about life and everything changes, which, you know, sounds kind of simple, but if we start taking it to think about, well, okay, like language itself changes, ourselves change. There is no permanent or constant self. All of the people that I love and all the things that I have, all of those are changing. If you follow that thread out, you know, it can take you to some really interesting places. And I think in some ways, the whole of the Buddhist tradition is exploring this idea of impermanence. The other central idea that, you know, emerges from the Four Noble Truths is that suffering is caused by ignorance, hatred, and desire. So these are known as the three poisons in the Buddhist tradition. Mm. And often when people are reading the Four Noble Truths, they'll really focus in on desire because the Buddha talks sort of most about that. But the Buddha, you know, later in all of the other texts, always connects these three things, which is to say, desire, I want this thing, hatred, I don't want that thing. So attachment and aversion. And then underlying both of that is a fundamental ignorance, and not ignorance in the sense of not knowing, but delusory ignorance in the sense of actively misunderstanding the world. So it is the fact that we react to the world in terms of, I like this, I don't like this, I hate this, I want this, and actively misperceiving the world. One of the Buddha's key insights is that those three factors are the thing that drives us to behave in ways that cause ourselves suffering. And so in order to eliminate suffering, you have to look back into your mind to understand how those three forces are driving your behavior and try to figure out a way to get rid of them, to pull them up by the root, as is a common Tibetan expression.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just nodding along and I'm thinking for any of the yogis listening, or, you know, people who have studied the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali and classical yoga philosophy, this sounds really familiar, right? These are three of the five kleshas or mental afflictions, raga, dvesha, and they're all rooted. So attraction or craving, and dvesha, pushing away or aversion. And they're rooted in avidya, or ignorance, or misperception. And so there's some really important and interesting overlap. It's something we've spent previous episodes on the podcast and entire courses at Yogic Studies exploring some of these overlaps between yoga and Buddhist philosophy and practice. But it's interesting that that's really one of the core contributions and teachings of the Buddha. And it's also really important and right there kind of in the heart of the teachings of the yoga tradition.
Yeah. And, you know, the Buddhist tradition uses that same term, klesha, obscuration or affliction.
Yep.
And, you know, it's amazing that scholars ever thought that these traditions were separate. It seems so clear, as I'm sure you've explored in all of these yogic studies courses, that these people are talking to each other. They're sharing a lot of ideas. And
yes, well, sometimes, you know, Patanjali is accused of being like a quasi Buddhist.
you say that like it's a bad thing.
Well, he's definitely not a Buddhist when it comes to other philosophical doctrines. Okay. You know, Purusha or Atman, you might say, which does seem to be a fault line, between some of the more Hindu Brahminical Indian traditions and the Buddhist ones. Do you have any thoughts about that? You know, you talked about impermanence being one of the real key ideas of the Buddha, and in particular, an impermanence of everything, including one's self. So this idea of un-Atman or not self. What do we make of that? I know it's a complex and debated topic across these traditions.
Yeah, and it's interesting chatting with people or talking with students here is, you know, we talk about this Buddhist teaching of not self, and you have to understand that what they're denying as self is very, very targeted at this kind of Upanishadic Hindu idea of what the Atman is. And so, right. You know, some of my students will be confused. They're like, why are we going through all the work of denying this thing that I didn't even really think anyway? Which is part of why we do this historical context to understand why the Buddha thought it was important. And I would say that, you know, this is a distinctive thing for the Buddhists because they don't want there to be anything permanent or eternal. That goes against this whole idea of impermanence, that everything comes into being, exists, and passes away. And so the notion that there is an Atman is just sort of antithetical to their whole approach to things. But that said, lots of Buddhists get accused by other Buddhists of being, you know, crypto Hindus, we might say,
right,
of trying to work that back in.
Right.
And so some early Buddhists will talk about, okay, there's not a self, but there is a person. There is a pudgala, or, mm-hmm, you know, certainly in later tantric Buddhist traditions, you'll have this kind of Buddha nature or things of that nature that try to get back at, you know, what a self does for you. And so I try to emphasize to students that why did the Buddha think that it was a problem to talk about the self or to think that you had a self? And why did some Buddhists then feel the need to try to bring back in something that was kind of like a self, but wasn't a self?
Mm.
And, you know, so instead of trying to just be like, okay, here's a bunch of doctrines, memorize them, to try to understand what are the problems these people are trying to solve with these ideas, right? Because ideas don't exist in a vacuum. The Buddha was famously against just philosophical speculation. He said, if this isn't going to help you eliminate suffering, like, I don't want to bother talking about it.
Right.
And so always trying to connect it back to suffering.
Right. There's the famous story. I mean, there's so many good ones, a lot of them from the Jataka tales, like the past lives of the Buddha. But you'll have to tell me where this is from. But something like someone gets shot with an arrow, and he's asking, where did it come from? What is the source of the arrow? Rather than simply removing the arrow, removing the suffering, he's asking why and how and where did it come from? This kind of philosophical speculation about the arrow, rather than actually taking the means to simply immediately remove and eradicate his suffering right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always find this. So this is, I believe, from the Chula Malukya Sutta.
Okay.
So it's like an anecdote that the Buddha told, and always the image of this poor, you know, it's portrayed as sort of an upper class Brahmin sort of person who's been shot by this arrow. And he says, you know, what was the caste of the person who shot this arrow at me? What's their
right
profession?
Right.
You know, what are they, you know, just trying to ask all of these silly questions instead of getting the arrow that is killing you out, mm-hmm, of your body. And so the Buddha does always sort of want to come back to that. What is, you know, what is going to help eliminate suffering? Mm.
So what are some common misperceptions? We talked about perception, right?
Yeah.
What are some common misperceptions that you think just people in general, or maybe just kind of the broader public, the way kind of Buddhism perhaps is portrayed in the public, as a scholar of Buddhism, as one who teaches at a university about Buddhist traditions, as the director of Buddhist Studies Online, you must have,
yeah,
encountered all kinds of things out there. So what would you say are just some common misperceptions people have?
I would say the number one most common misperception that students continually repeat back to me, even after I try to dissuade them of this notion, is that Buddhism is synonymous with meditation.
Mm.
So, and that's because, you know, meditation and mindfulness are very popular in our modern context. They're sort of associated with Buddhism. People are often interested in that. And so that aspect of Buddhism has been kind of really focused on. And so what I'll say to people is that 99.9% of Buddhists throughout history never meditated a day in their lives.
They don't meditate. That's right.
Yeah. And the reason, you know, so we get into that, you know, in module 3 of the course where we look at techniques, we talk about, you know, morality, monasticism, meditation. It was seen as kind of a progression. Meditation in the modern US is kind of an entry point to Buddhism. You're feeling stressed out, sit down for 30 minutes, try to kind of calm your mind.
Right. And then after you've meditated a little bit, you might be curious to learn more about, you know, where and how this practice came to be. And you might read more about the philosophy and history.
Yeah. And if you in the audience came to it that way, more power to you. I think that's great. What I come in as a historian and say is that most Buddhists thought of meditation as a fairly elite practice that was only able to be done by a select few who had done a lot of philosophical study already and were almost certainly monks. So, you know, your average lay person, your average kind of householder person would have been too busy taking care of the kids and doing work and, you know, all sorts of stuff. They wouldn't have had time to sort of sit and meditate. And they also wouldn't have thought themselves capable of that. At that particular stage on the Buddhist path, they would have seen their responsibility to the Buddhist community as being making donations and supporting Buddhist monks and nuns, supporting temples, supporting monasteries, and hoping that the merit that they accumulated by doing so would mean that sometime in a future rebirth, they would get born as a monk or nun who would be able to do these kinds of more advanced practices.
Do you think that's changed though in recent years, not just in the West, but in Buddhist countries as well? Do you think more and more lay Buddhists have turned to meditation?
Yes. So starting in the 1800s, and people think that this first started in Burma, there's a great book by Braun is his last name. I'm trying to remember his first name. He's a professor at UVA. Another student of Janet Yatso's, who is my advisor, looking at the origins of mass meditation and how that started. So there's a particular history there. And what's interesting about that history is it was in large part Burmese monks trying to reform Buddhism to take it back to its roots because they thought that the British colonial occupation of Burma was going to be a threat to Buddhism. So in some sense, there was this perception of an outside threat that was going to destroy the Buddhist heritage. You needed to go back to the roots. They looked back at the early texts. They saw the Buddha talking about meditation, and this real transformative figure, a monk who was in charge at the time, whose name I am blanking on, started preaching that meditation was something that all people could do and benefit from, and preaching Vipassana meditation in particular. And so it is a really important thing that, you know, Asian Buddhists started doing. It also became, you know, quite popular in the West because those were sort of the practices that the people who initially, but initially encountered Buddhism and brought it back to the West were particularly interested in. And so these days, lots and lots of Buddhists in both Asia and the West will have meditation as form of their practice. I will also say that meditation is something that we can define in lots of ways.
Right.
You know, maybe you've been doing the dishes and fallen into this sort of concentrated state, you know, it's quasi-meditation. The thing that probably looks closest to meditation for lots of Buddhists is chanting of sutras. And chanting practices do seem to be much more widespread. And so when I say 99.9% of Buddhists never meditated, I mean, they probably didn't sit in lotus posture with their eyes partially closed.
Right, and because you're saying that would have been a practice reserved more for monks and nuns and sort of professional religionists, if you will.
Yes.
Yeah, that is quite interesting, and in some ways, kind of reminds me just on the yoga side. You know, today yoga is almost, you know, singularly associated with stretching, with physical postures, And actually, for much of yoga's history, yoga meant something closer to meditation. But today, we don't think of yoga as meditation. You might do yoga and meditate, but that would be something separate or different. So today, you know, yoga in some ways has, at least in popular culture, to do yoga, to practice yoga, has been reduced to doing asanas or postures. Yet the history is much more complex, and asana or posture is, you know, just this one smaller piece of that. Not a perfect parallel, but just another example of the way in which a tradition and a complex host of practices and ideas are kind of in some ways reduced to a much more narrow form. So that's an interesting misperception. Looking more broadly, let's talk about the field of Buddhist studies as an academic field with researchers and scholars from around the world. This is, you know, scholars have been studying Buddhism, at least in Western universities, for at least a couple hundred years. The encounter between East and West obviously goes back much further. Recently, what are some vibrant areas of scholarship, would you say, within the broader field of Buddhist studies?
Yeah, so the sort of initial encounter with Buddhism was often focused on kind of extracting what the, you know, particular person who was interested in Buddhism at the time, often a sort of upper class white male of some, you know, Christian persuasion, thought was valuable, and stripping out what he thought was not valuable. And so a lot of the early study of Buddhism is interested in separating out the Buddha's philosophy from the things that, you know, he didn't like. And in the past, you know, 40 years, there's been a big shift in the field to say, no, our job as scholars is not to say, okay, this is good, this is bad, like this is superstition and therefore bad. It's actually to just understand the tradition on its own terms rather than making it fit our conceived notion of what religion is or should be. And so to that end, there's been a movement away from studying only the kind of central philosophical texts of the Buddha to studying the whole wide range of things that people did. So people are now interested in more material culture. They're interested in what lay people did. They're interested in literature and art and not kind of only the philosophy. So what you get now is a much richer picture of the Buddhist tradition, as opposed to just saying, okay, what are the central philosophical ideas, and we can leave all the rest behind. And so, you know, my research is, I hopefully think, an example of that. People often thought that pilgrimage was kind of this popular practice that everyday people did, and therefore it wasn't that interesting, because what, you know, the real Buddhists were doing was philosophy and meditation. And when we kind of take this more expansive view of Buddhist history, we can look and say, well, actually, when you look at this pilgrimage tradition, it's fascinating in all these ways. One, because it connects to this central problem of misperception. Two, because it raises all these questions about material culture and internal versus external that we were talking before. And third, it's just what most Buddhists were doing most of the time. Most people weren't meditating, but they were going on pilgrimage. They were kind of doing everyday practices. And so the trend in the field of Buddhist studies today is just to expand and try to appreciate the richness of what a Buddhist life looked like in the past.
Yeah, and I think at Buddhist Studies Online, we're going to really try to embrace all of that and try to put together a really diverse and rich curriculum of courses. I think, you know, Kate and I have been working hard behind the scenes to think up our dream curriculum here. And we definitely want to have like the quote unquote traditional classes to study kind of, you know, a lot of the major and root texts of the tradition, to get that history and really in-depth philosophical study, but also to bring out some of these new areas of research, looking at Buddhist art and ritual and ethics and narrative. So this might be a good segue. Maybe you can tell us a little bit. We've talked about your course, this BS 101, Intro to Buddhism. But what's coming up on deck? We've got the first four courses, I think, officially mapped out, and folks can check out on the website. Maybe mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about those courses and then what we can expect beyond that.
Yeah, so those of you who are interested in meditation and mindfulness that I mentioned in, you know, just one of the modules in my course can look forward to BSO 102, which is Meditation in Theory and Practice. And so that's going to be an even richer and more in-depth look at the history of Buddhist meditation and mindfulness practices, breaking down what are the different practices, how did people think about them, how did they write about them, how did they actually do them. And the professor there is Daniel Stewart, who has done a lot of research on these topics. And I think it'll be a really exciting opportunity. I think I might, you know, dip myself into that course and watch the lectures and do some learning.
Yeah, me too. And we wanted to put that course right up front because we know a lot of people will be coming into this, as we said, with some experience of having done Buddhist meditation. Maybe you've done a 10-day Vipassana retreat. The instructor, Daniel Stewart, he's actually written a book about Goenka, Burmese meditation teacher who's founded this modern Vipassana Renaissance movement. So I'm sure that'll be a rich theme of the course and kind of the history of this insight meditation tradition.
Yeah. And so then the next course is Buddhism 103, Intro to Buddhist Philosophy, taught by Sonam Khatru, who was a classmate of mine back in the University of Chicago, although it's a stretch because I was a master's student and he was this big, you know, hotshot PhD student at the time. And that's going to really dive into the philosophical side. So my 101 course is going to try to cover, you know, the practices, the art, the history, the narrative, the literature. It's going to be a lot of different genres, really wide ranging. And so for someone who really wants to delve into the philosophy side in particular, Sonam's course is going to be a really great fit because he is trained in Buddhist philosophy, got his PhD at the University of Chicago. And so if you really want to look at the debates of, you know, early Buddhist philosophers trying to figure out the notion of the self, what are the sort of components of reality? How do they interact with one another? What are the philosophical disputes that led to the separation of the Mahayana? And what did Mahayana philosophers debate among themselves in terms of Madhyamaka, Yogacara, all these different kinds of things? Sonam's course is going to be great.
Yeah, and I think it'll really crack open this idea of the multiplicity of Buddhisms, plural, to see that there were real vigorous debates and contestations over the Buddha's teachings, kind of what we were talking about before, this level of interpretation. Well, different schools of Buddhist thought that developed along these lines of interpreting the speech and the words of the Buddha.
Yeah, and that's another misconception that people will have, is that all Buddhists were kind of out, you know, just sort of like blissed out, chanting Om, meditating, doing sorts of things. And, you know, when you look into the history of Buddhist philosophy, you see incredibly detailed, sophisticated, rigorous debates that come up with ideas that people working in sort of Western philosophy are only catching up with now, that are extremely rigorous, logical presentations of how the world works.
Yeah, at Yogic Studies right now, we have this incredible course going on right now with Dr. Philip Moss on Sankhya philosophy, reading the Sankhya Karikas of Ishvara Krishna. And it's a great example of just that, this incredibly precise school that's using logic and reason and doesn't exist in this cultural or philosophical vacuum, but these thinkers were in dialogue with all of these other philosophers from other schools, and in particular, the Buddhists. So the yogins, the Sankhyans, the Vedantins, and the Buddhists were intellectual sparring partners, if you will. And to understand one, you have to understand the other and all of its multiplicities.
Exactly. And so that leads me to the fourth course, which is actually a 200 level. So we have these 101 level things that are intros, and then we have 200 level courses that are focused on studying particular texts. Mm. And the teacher for this one is Jay Garfield of Smith College. It also teaches at Harvard. So I actually took a course quite like this from him at Harvard, but it'll be focused on Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatara, that is how to be a Bodhisattva. Mm. And Shantideva's a 7th century Mahayana monk living in North India, and writes this text that becomes just such a central touchstone for Indian Mahayana Buddhism, Tibetan Mahayana Buddhism. You know, it's one of the texts that everyone who's a monk studies. It's been hugely influential. And what this text does is it's got, you know, 10 chapters that break down the steps towards becoming an enlightened being. So how do you live an enlightened life? How do you go about doing that? What are the steps? What are the order? Where do you start? And Shantideva kind of explores the factors of human psychology one by one as they can be transformed towards trying to attain the awakened life. And so in that course, students will be reading the Bodhicharya Avatara closely with Jay Garfield, who's written a lot on this text. Mm. And, you know, just getting a really in-depth understanding of this rich work of Buddhist philosophy, but also this rich work of Buddhist literature. It's written in this incredibly beautiful poetry,
right,
and with vivid images and, you know, moving. Parts of it are funny, parts of it are disgusting, parts of it are sad. Mm. You know, it really, sometimes we think that philosophical texts are just like, okay, here's an idea, here's an idea, here's an idea. But all of us know that when persuading people, use of emotion, use of imagery, use of literature is so important. And Buddhists have understood that from the beginning. So this is one of my absolute favorite Buddhist texts. And so when we were setting up the curriculum, I was the one who was like, we have to read How to Be a Bodhisattva.
Yeah.
So I think the students will really like it.
Yeah, it's a classic, influential text for all these reasons. But we were also so pleased to have Jay Garfield sign on and to teach it. I mean, all of our instructors who we've just named so far, if any of them are listening, thank you for saying yes, a huge vote of confidence in Buddhist studies online. But we're really fortunate to just have really, really talented, dynamic scholars and teachers, to join us, to, expose, you all to, we're really excited to see this grow. We see Buddhist Studies Online as the sister institute to yogic studies. And I'm sure there'll be some interesting opportunities for engagement across platforms as time goes. One of the things that, you know, again, we're kind of taking this model from yogic studies and we're trying to now develop and build out for BSO is a traditional language study. Kind of going back to the beginning of our conversation, Kate was talking about her experiences learning Hindi, studying Sanskrit and Tibetan, even a little bit of Ladakhi, and how not just influential, but how vital, how fundamental learning those languages are to be able to access these texts, these traditions in the depth that we're all craving. So, I mean, one of the things that has been most rewarding at Yogic Studies is this Sanskrit language program that we've developed. And now how many, like a few hundred people actually who have gone through first year Sanskrit. We've just come to the end. They're actually taking their final exams right now this week. And actually the success rate that we have of people going all the way through it and actually passing their exam, listeners might know, like, there's actually pretty low success rate in Sanskrit courses. A lot of people drop in out because it is tough. You got to stick it out. But making high level language training available to the general public, we're going to do that at Buddhist Studies Online as well. Kate, maybe you can tell us what languages kind of we've got in store that we're hoping to develop.
Yeah, so we're thinking of starting with Pali, and this is the language of the early Buddhist scriptures. And Pali is an interesting language. It's closely related to Sanskrit, but not quite Sanskrit. It's interestingly different in certain ways. But early Buddhists think that it is the language closest to what the Buddha preached in, and it became the central, you know, holy scriptural language for Theravada Buddhism, which is the form of Buddhism practiced in Sri Lanka and most of Southeast Asia. So there's a long tradition of this language being used for Buddhism. And
yeah, one of my early teachers, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but he used to say Pali is like speaking Sanskrit with peanut butter in your mouth. So instead of dharma, it's dhamma. I'm sure there's many other examples like that.
Yeah, instead of nirvana, it's nibbana.
Nibbana, yeah.
So you get these vowels or conjunct consonants that kind of get...
So if you have some Sanskrit behind you, like if you've done our Sanskrit courses at YS, you'll definitely have a leg up going into Pali, but you can totally start Pali without anything. And you'll also be, you know, you'll be in a good spot. There'll be a lot of people with no language training behind them. You know, we will start at ground zero.
Yeah. And what's so valuable about doing this is that, you know, whenever we're trying to put things in English, we're trying to put things in conceptual categories that are familiar with us, familiar to us. And just by virtue of the fact that English is developed in a largely Christian context, it often contains a lot of the Christian worldview or Christian values in it. And so when you are encountering a scriptural text in the original language, and when you're learning to translate it, you recognize that there's not necessarily this one-to-one correspondence of, okay, here's a Pali word, here's an English word. Instead, each word kind of has its own richness and set of associations that can be captured by a couple of different English words, and you have to make a choice about which one to do. And so the process of delving in, of trying to make those choices, trying to understand what terms mean in their own context, is just about the best way I know to really slow yourself down and savor every word. Try to think about how they fit together, what they really mean. And so it's, you know, a really valuable thing to do if you're able to.
Yeah. And then I think once we've got the Pali courses underway, we also like to develop some online Tibetan courses. And I know this is something Kate is very, very passionate about. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about, you know, learning Tibetan and what sort of texts and what opens up through studying the Tibetan language?
Yeah, so, you know, I specialize in Tibetan. I think Tibetan is great. I'm so excited for everyone to learn it. That's going to be definitely or probably our second language on deck after Pali. And when you study Tibetan, you get to read a lot of Sanskrit texts that no longer we have access to in the Sanskrit. So actually, you know, we mentioned the Bodhicharya Avatara, originally written in Sanskrit, but actually some chapters were lost and we only have them available in Tibetan. And so in order to read that text in anything close to the original language, you have to have access to the Tibetan. I, of course, will speak highly that you can read pilgrimage texts, but I know that those are not always the most popular. but you can read, you know, teachings by the Dalai Lama or teachings by previous Dalai Lamas or Tsongkhapa, the probably most famous teacher in Tibetan history. You can read the incredible poetry of Tibetan authors. And
how about, you know, autobiographies?
Oh, yes. Speaking again of Jigme Lingpa, who Seth channeled earlier, he is a famous Tibetan writer of the Nyingma school, which, you know, is one of the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, and has this incredible autobiography that our teacher, Janet Gatso, translated. But you can go and read it in the original. You can also read stories about figures like Milarepa or Padmasambhava, Yeshe Tsogyal, all of these incredible and inspiring figures that the Tibetan tradition looks to for inspiration.
Right. And for anybody also who, if you took on yogic studies, the Tibetan yoga course with Ian Baker, you'll also know there are all these really fascinating and overlooked Tibetan texts teaching with teachings on yoga theory and practice. And really, if anybody is serious about kind of entering into this world of scholarship, and you kind of come from the yoga side, but you're looking to bridge yoga and Buddhism, there's a lot of interesting room for further research on physical and hatha yoga and how those practices developed and were adapted in Tibet. Just real quick plug for that course too, Tibetan Yoga with Ian Baker. It was a pretty incredible course, but there's a huge, just like Sanskrit in Tibet and in the Tibetan language, there's a huge and vast corpus of texts that only a small percentage have even been translated out of Tibetan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Tibetans loved to write, and even sort of minor religious figures, you can look them up on the Tibetan Buddhist Digital Resource, and they'll have, you know, collected writings that are 50 volumes long, which scholarship has really only scratched the surface of.
Yep. And then beyond that, you know, we're going to other courses coming down the road. We'll certainly do different courses on regional Buddhisms, maybe, you know, Buddhism in Japan. We'd like to, you know, have a course on Zen Buddhism, certainly Tibetan Buddhism, which we've talked a lot about today. But please let us know, too, if there are particular courses or subjects, areas of interest. You can reach out to Kate at info@BuddhistStudiesOnline.com. So, Kate, as we start to wrap up here, I have one more question for you of kind of just bringing this all together to our current moment. You know, we've been talking about this incredibly ancient and yet dynamic, you know, this multiplicity of traditions that we call Buddhism. You know, how is this 2,500-year-old tradition, how is the study of Buddhism relevant today?
Great question, Seth. And I think it's incredibly relevant. You know, all of us are struggling with a lot of the same problems that the Buddha talks about, of suffering, of feeling our lives to be one thing after the other. We're just stressed and everyone wants something from us, and we never get any time to just sort of be. And we're just constantly bombarded with things. And Buddhism provides a way of understanding how to live in a world like that. You know, we can think, for instance, of the ways that we're constantly assaulted on social media or by advertisements or by all of these things. And we think that we're able to kind of navigate our way through them by choosing things. But as all of us know, we often choose what's not very good for us. We humans have a good way of doing that. And so the Buddha's idea that we are driven by anger or a hatred, desire, and delusion provides a way of understanding why we act in the world. So why did I click that thing when I knew I didn't even really want to? I was just bored and wanted some stimulation. It provides a way of stepping back and analyzing our behavior from this kind of third person perspective and offering ways of reshaping that behavior. Because I do think that part of the reason that meditation and mindfulness are so popular in today's world is that they're addressing a real need. Our minds are so overstimulated and torn at from every angle that if we can slow down and observe and think about what leads us to act or think or behave in certain ways, we have a better chance of changing the ways that we act or think or believe. And so for all of these reasons, I think that studying Buddhism, both in an academic or in a practice context, can be highly, highly valuable in today's world.
Well said. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Kate. It's been great to get to know you a little bit more and hear about your story and your fascinating, you know, research that you've done on Tibetan Buddhism, pilgrimage. And I think I can speak for all of us. We're really excited for Buddhist Studies Online, for your course coming up, Intro to Buddhism, and just all of this really rich material and curriculum that we've been talking about here today. So big thanks for being a part of all of this, Kate.
Yeah, and thank you so much for, you know, having me on this podcast, but also, you know, inviting me to start this journey of Buddhist Studies Online with you. Couldn't have asked for a better, you know, buddy to do this with.
And little plug coming up, hopefully Kate doesn't get mad at me for saying this, but some folks have been asking, we are going to be launching the Buddhist Studies podcast, and Kate is going to be the host of that new podcast. So look out for that coming pretty soon.
Nice. Cat's out of the bag.
Yeah. So now you got to do it, right? No,
now
going back.
Do it.
Now you got to do it.
The people will be clamoring.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks again, Kate. Thanks everybody for listening, for making it this far. Please go check out BuddhistStudiesOnline.com. Check out Kate's upcoming course. There's a early bird tuition pricing going on right now. So check that out. Please let us know what you think. Please, you know, be in touch. And yeah, thanks everyone. Please take care.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Yogic Studies podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or sharing this episode with someone else. Thanks so much, everyone. Until next time, please take care.